F. Kennedy Jr., the 69-year-old environmental lawyer and third child of RFK, formally announced he was running for the Democratic presidential nomination, becoming the fourth Kennedy to launch a White House run. A candidate willing to condemn the consolidation of corporate power, the evils of environmental racism and ever-increasing income inequality. And a Kennedy to boot. What more could Democrats ask for? Well, a lot, actually. Forgive me, but a Bannon-backed, Tucker-platformed anti-vaxxer conspiracy theorist who's running on his Kennedy name but can't count on the support of the actual Kennedys is perhaps not the progressive or principled or anti-establishment or liberal Democratic Party champion that he might want you to think he is.
Should we treat Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s pronouncements about vaccines, about cell phones, about all kinds of things that he says that are not rooted in scientific fact, as serious, even as he's contending for the nomination for the presidency of the United States?
I understand the question, and I just don't understand why we're still talking about this in 2023. Look, we dismissed Donald Trump in 2015. Mm-hmm. He's not a serious candidate. He doesn't have a serious following. And further, it's not like the media can be gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. They used to be. He's running around. He's on all these different podcasts. He's using all the different types of methods. More news organizations should cover him seriously because he is serious. He is at 20-something percent in the polling. And look at how we're covering Nikki Haley, who's at 3%, or Mike Pence, who's at 6. He's at 20.
Welcome back to The Popular Show with me, James A. Smith. This episode is part of an occasional series that we're going to be running in the approach to the 2024 U.S. presidential election, covering the candidates and speaking to their supporters. We are currently uncommitted and unaligned on this show, and we're going to be talking to people who want to make the case for some of the individuals who are running in this extremely interesting collection of potential candidates. RFK Jr. is going to have the case made for him by Aaron Good, who I'm thrilled we could get on the podcast. He is the author of American Exception, Empire and the Deep State, which is published by Skyhorse Books, and he's also the host of the American Exception podcast. Thanks so much for joining us on The Popular Show, Aaron Good.
Hey, thanks, James. Great to be here.
I'm so glad you agreed to do this. For listeners who maybe don't know your work, I feel that your interest in RFK Jr. is actually very personal as well as political, and is kind of family based. You're among a sort of group of thinkers who sees the assassination of JFK and of RFK as one of the real keystones in American history, and one of the things that the American people have been lied to about. I wondered if for the uninitiated you could kind of give your standard kind of account of why that's important, what's missing in the standard rendition, and what the significance of that is for politics today.
Well, it's a tricky thing to try to briefly summarize, but let me try to take a different angle on this than I have in the past that I think might be illuminating, just to describe America and try not to have any illusions about the deep problems that the country has always, faced and serious contradictions it's always faced. By the time of the Great Depression, you had a struggle over what people were going to do over this terrible economic situation. And some people wanted a fascist sort of government to basically bring things back to normal and make things operate as the way that the rulers and ruling class always wanted it to operate. And other people thought, for whatever reason, some of them were sincere and believed in like liberal reforms. And other people thought maybe if we don't reform a little bit, we risk like losing everything because there's potential for revolution. Whatever the result is, the U.S. goes for New Deal reform capitalism in the 30s with Franklin Roosevelt's administration. And it's the most progressive administration probably in U.S. history on the whole, even as it coexisted with a the most reactionary part of the political system, which was the, you know, segregationists in the South. So it's a contradictory formulation, no doubt, but it was even still the most progressive administration in U.S. history. But during World War II, the oligarchy of private wealth centered around Wall Street, represented by Wall Street's think tank, the Council on Foreign Relations, they were given backing by Roosevelt's State Department to essentially plan U.S. entry into World War II and plans for the post-war world order. And these guys saw a huge opportunity to become the hegemon of global capitalism. They figured the U.S. with its industrial power was going to end up eventually winning, being on a winning side at the end of World War II. And they would enter the war, of course, and they start planning for this in 1939, really. So they're planning for this right away. They're saying, like, well, we're going to eventually enter the war, and then we're going to win, and then this is the world we're going to have. And that's what happens. The U.S. wins, and the U.S. policymakers construct a world order based around the U.S. dollar for the capitalist countries, and they create institutions like the IMF and the World Bank to deal with international economic situations. And they create the CIA to manage, supposedly to defend against communism, but what it really ends up doing is managing the transition from colonialism to neocolonialism. So especially countries that are resource rich, that corporations, Western corporations exploit in the third world, meaning not in the Soviet sphere, not in the, you know, advanced quote unquote Western world. In the third world, countries, if they got out of line, if they were enacting policies that were deemed, you know, harmful to the interests of U.S. corporations or the U.S. national interest, quote unquote, as determined by typically Wall Street representatives in the government and so on, then the CIA could step in and, you know, overthrow a leader like a Mossadegh in Iran or a Arbenz in Guatemala or eventually a Sukarno in Indonesia and, you know, all those countries. So you could go down the list of the countries that where the CIA has overthrown people, supposedly to fight communism, but these are policies that existed, you know, especially in like Latin America, the so-called banana republics before World War II, and they're policies that existed after World War II, like when we, you know, back this coup in Peru, the regime is still in there right now, or we supported lawfare against Lula, or assassination attempts against Maduro, and coups against Nicaragua and Venezuela, you know, additionally, Chavez, we tried to get him in 2002 or 2003. So it's the same policy. It's empire. This is the U.S. situation. Now, JFK comes to office in 1960 after the Eisenhower administration, 2 years of really consolidating U.S. imperialism and corporate dominance of foreign policy and U.S. politics, you know, led by the Dulles brothers at CIA head and Secretary of State, representatives of Sullivan and Cromwell Law Firm, the biggest corporate law firm in the, you know, representing the biggest corporations in the world, basically. So after 8 years of that, Kennedy takes office, but the whole U.S. political system has accepted as common sense and basically prevailing unquestionable orthodoxy, the Cold War. Okay, but the Cold War is really a contrivance. I mean, the Soviet Union didn't want a Cold War. They would have been happy trading with the West. They didn't want an arms race. The U.S., you know, at the end of the war, the U.S. gratuitously nukes two Japanese cities, I'd say to send a message to the Soviets. And then in 1946, we tell our allies, the Soviets, who had just lost $27 million people fighting the Nazis and basically bequeathing to the U.S. control of global capitalism. And in, you know, to thank them for this, we tell them that we're going to nuke them in 1946. So we're going to nuke you if you don't withdraw from Iran. Which, if you look at Iran, it's a long way off, a long way away from the United States. But Britain was there, and Britain is a key ally for the U.S. So they say, get out of there. Let the British run around, more or less.
Yeah.
So the U.S. wanted the Cold War. They created it. They ginned it up. They exaggerated it in different ways to manage and create the kind of international climate that would allow them to create and reign over a system of global capitalism. JFK takes office, and there's no way anyone is going to be a president without basically accepting the Cold War calculus. So he says many things about the Cold War that are sometimes even more aggressive than Richard Nixon, who's like, the poster child for American anti-communism. Kennedy beats him, sometimes making dubious arguments, making dubious statements about the Cold War as a whole. But in office, he's actually surprisingly restrained. He refuses to, he accepts the plan for the Bay of Pigs invasion, which he later says is the biggest mistake of his life and the worst moment of his life. But he is pressed by the military and the CIA to send in U.S. military, and he won't do it. He refuses to. He says later, you know, they thought I would fold because I'm young and new, and I surprised them. So he accepted failure for that, and surprisingly, his approval ratings went up. And they wanted him to fight in Laos and send ground troops in Laos to deal with the crisis in Laos right about the same time. And he actually says to people, well, you know, if it weren't for the Bay of Pigs, I might even take these guys seriously, but I don't want to do this. So they work out a different solution. He avoids war in Laos. But he's got all these pressures on the Cold War and around him. And he, you know, to deal with Cuba in that situation, he foolishly launches minor, mostly superficial, but mistaken campaigns against the Cubans, Operation Mongoose. And he refuses to send ground troops into Vietnam adamantly, despite them making every argument about why that was necessary. But he sends in advisors to train them and then supposedly leave when the training is done so the South Vietnamese can defend their country and freedom and so on. Okay. Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 1962 changes Kennedy somewhat. I think that he had already been anti-war, and he'd said things to people to the effect of, like, look, the president's job is to keep the country out of war, and I'm basically almost a peace at any price president. So he was always anti-war, and he refused to enter into any hot wars, but he did go along with and pursue certain Cold War policies that were, you know, I mean, the whole Cold War itself was gratuitous and a kind of a scam to begin with. So it's not that he's like a saint or he's a pure leftist who always had a leftist ideology that he applied to running the office of the presidency. There's no way that that would ever happen in the United States at that time. So these, a lot of the arguments against Kennedy that are made by doctrinaire leftists are, so misguided and silly. You don't even know what to say about it. But he, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, as he began to understand more that, like, Mongoose and other operations actually, you know, instigated this, that this was a fear of the U.S. invading Cuba that was not unreasonable, which is why they wanted those missiles there, even though that was a drastic action and it almost brought the world to nuclear doomsday, you could understand. Kennedy starts pursuing more policies of accommodation with the Soviet Union and with Cuba, even as these other operations continue sort of normally. He has these back channel discussions with Castro and with Khrushchev about normalizing relations even with Cuba. Yeah, basically, the argument that he was making was they can practice. You're going to have this communist system. This is your choice. Just stop exporting revolution, because this makes it untenable for me politically. Like this, so there were negotiations that were ongoing about this. He signs an order in October of 1963, beginning a withdrawal plan from Vietnam, with the first withdrawing of advisors to be completed, you know, within a month, and then the rest to be completed by the end of 1965. So he issues an order for Vietnam withdrawal, phase Vietnam withdrawal, not to be completed until after the election, so there couldn't be any cries of, like, you lost Indochina or you lost Vietnam. This was his plan. He told people explicitly about it, that the issue was he couldn't do it before the election. So he left those people in harm's way, is one way to say it. He didn't want to take the political risk at the time, because he didn't think that was the thing to do. He thought it would hurt his chances. And if he's not elected, you can't do anything. If he's not reelected, you can't go to try to end the Cold War. He makes speeches in the summer of 1963 on consecutive days, calling for re-examining our attitudes with the Soviet Union about peace, re-examining our attitudes about peace in general and world peace, and how we have to believe in world peace. It's horrifying to think that in the age of nuclear war that you can't even imagine a world at peace. I mean, this just means that we're sooner or later going to nuke ourselves. And he said as much. So, and he also gave a speech calling for the end of Jim Crow, even though that's a big part of his constituency, a Southern segregationist. And he did it anyway. Like, it wasn't, Eisenhower could have done that, and he didn't rely on the Southern segregationists for any of his electoral base. He didn't do that. The Kennedys did way more in 1,000 days than the Eisenhower administration did in 8 years to advance the cause of civil rights, and Kennedy wrote the Civil Rights Act. Kennedy was the most popular president in U.S. history by average opinion poll rating in the time that they kept those statistics and they started doing those polls. And he was, you know, at the end, calling for an end to segregation and an end to the Cold War and for peace and disarmament. And, you know, he got this nuclear test ban treaty signed and so on. So to me, it says that the American people are not as warlike and, you know, viciously racist as we want to be told that they are. But they have been manipulated and influenced by horrible leadership and a vicious oligarchy of corporate wealth bent on global dominance and maximum exploitation and perpetuating their hegemony over humanity indefinitely into the future, because this is sort of the way civilizations have worked. People in power, that their whole existences revolve around advancing their power and increasing their wealth and so on. And that's the system the U.S. created, and Kennedy represented a democratic counterweight to that, a lowercase d. And as a result, he was a huge threat, and they assassinated him in a way that's really blatant when you just soberly look at the facts of the case.
The reason why successive commentators and writers, of which there are so many, but we might cite here the line from Peter Dale Scott to David Talbot to yourself, the reason why guys like this are so convinced that all of those unanswered questions and all of that palpable bullshit from the Warren Commission onwards in the official telling of the Kennedy assassination, the reason why that's important is not just on its own terms. It's very disturbing that a democratically elected and very popular president can be killed and the explanation can be so unconvincing. It's also important because basically that was a turning point for how far there is democratic oversight of foreign policy in America. It was a turning point in the sense that it was the moment that made clear that kind of path of peace, that path of de-escalation of the Cold War in general, Vietnam in particular, that kind of tolerance for different spheres of influence and different forms of governance was not going to be the path. And basically everything that's happened since has been a sort of charging to the right. So if I understand your work correctly, and certainly those other guys I mentioned, the reason why it's important not to let go of this and not to just sort of say, well, it was a long time ago and we don't want to be tarred as cranks, is that this was a real turning point in American history and one that we are still trying to awaken from. In that sense, it's quite right that when the son of Bobby Kennedy, the nephew of JFK, comes along and wants to run for president in 2024, that one should listen. But how far does RFK Jr., in your view, share the analysis that you just gave of his family history? And how far is he signed up to the alternative account that says, one, he was killed by some sort of elite conspiracy. JFK was killed by some sort of elite conspiracy, and probably RFK Senior as well. And how far do you see that being a constituent part of RFK Junior's politics today?
I think that it's huge, and this is the first time I've ever explained this way, or because I don't know that it's something I've just sort of been recognizing more in my head lately as being connected. But
great,
what happened to me was I was a political science major, and then I worked on political campaigns, and in 2008 I worked for Obama, and Obama ended up being not the change that we could believe in or whatever. He was a total phony Wall Street Muppet, you know, automaton, awful, a disaster, right? He just consolidated all the Bush, you know, fascism, moved towards a more overt fascism. So I At this time, I was reading more, looking at more critical sources online, and somehow I saw Oliver Stone talking about the book JFK and the Unspeakable on Bill Maher. And I don't really watch Bill Maher. I think I just watched the video because Oliver Stone was on it. And so I just ordered the book. And then a while later, I read it. And I'd seen JFK in the theaters, and I'd read a little bit here and there, and I always thought, like, yeah, the CIA probably killed him. And it helped that by around 05-06, I read books on the CIA in Iran by, like, Stephen Kinzer, and I read Stephen Kinzer's Overthrow. So I actually understood a good bit about what U.S. foreign policy was, but it still, in my mind, seemed like, well, Obama really wants to change things, and Bush committed all these crimes. He's in the other party. Obama's a constitutional law professor. He's got him dead to rights. He's just waiting to get into office, and he's going to drop the hammer on him. Well, you find out later that Obama had discussions about prosecuting Bush for torture and other things, and they said, well, if you do that, there might be a coup, so you better not do that. That, among other things, Obama was terrible. So when I saw Oliver Stone talk about JFK and the Unspeakable, this new book, I ordered it and I read it, and it was shocking to me because it wasn't that, like, you could question the Warren Commission and its low nut who gets killed by another lone nut story. I mean, that's a ridiculous story on its face. So that's pretty blatant. But what really did shock me, going back and looking at the evidence as I was older and the way that it was presented by James Douglas in this book, was how overwhelmingly clear it was what had happened. Like, it's actually not much of a mystery at all. I mean, we don't know who was on, you know, who was behind the fence or whatever and fired that shot that hit Kennedy. In the temple, from the front, but that's because it was a state crime, and the full power of the state has been put into concealing this and covering it up immediately. It's so obvious, and so that was something that made me go on the path that I went on. I reached out to more radical academics. I started writing books, and I wanted to eventually come up with a theory of the state that would explain how something like an extra constitutional veto on a president in the form of assassination could be exercised by the state and then denied for decades forcibly and turned into a subject so radioactive that to even talk about it is suicidal for a career in journalism or media or politics or journalism, academia, politics, right? How can this be? And so I set out to do that and went to a graduate school and a PhD program, and I wrote a dissertation that I knew would get me disqualified for academic work, most likely, but I did it anyway, got that book published. But what I want to add, what's relevant about this to the Robert Kennedy Jr. thing, is that in 2013, he wrote an article for Rolling Stone where he explicitly praises the book JFK and the Unspeakable, and he explains about his uncle's vision for peace. And this was in the year of the 50th anniversary. So the article actually comes out on November 20th, 2013, which happens to be 2 days before the anniversary of the assassination. But it's also Robert Kennedy Sr.'s birthday. It's also my birthday, incidentally, which is weird. And Jim Garrison's birthday, too. And this article just says he echoes everything that's in JFK and the Unspeakable. And he writes about his uncle's vision of peace. And he says at the end how it's like this whole discussion about whether the U.S. should be the global dominator and whether we should be constantly, you know, this hegemonic imperialist force in the world. This has been taken out of the discussion period since JFK's death. So that's what it did. JFK's death is a turning point in that it reveals a sort of the real character of the regime that had emerged. But really what it was the period of JFK was a strange, a strange period in which he went against, it went against what came before and afterwards. So it's really the turning point in a way is JFK's election, but the turning point is crushed. So it's like really what happens with Johnson is it's a return to form of the Eisenhower years and a move to the right and a pro-big business, pro-imperialist foreign policy. And the results are, millions of dead people in Indonesia, Vietnam, Congo had millions of people die as a consequence of changes in policy that Kennedy was opposed to. It's been it's a catastrophe for the world what happened there. But what it amounted to was that Kennedy challenged a consensus, an imperial consensus that was at Wall Street and these institutions greatly influenced by Wall Street, the Pentagon and the CIA, they opposed this, the changes that Kennedy had. They were for the Cold War consensus, but the people weren't of the United States. They had to be coaxed and manipulated in different ways. And the Kennedys weren't. The Kennedy brothers wanted something different. They looked into the abyss, especially with the Cuban Missile Crisis, and they recoiled at what they saw. And they worked to try to pull America back from that. And so Robert Kennedy, the fact that Robert Kennedy had not said, nobody in the Kennedy family had said anything about the assassination in that kind of a public way until Robert Kennedy Jr., you know, wrote this piece. And he previously said right before that, shortly before that, other public statements about the assassination. But the fact that he wrote that article to me shows that his experience with this is similar to mine. And if this was enough to change my trajectory and basically make me do things that are foolish from a careerist perspective, I have to believe that for him, knowing that it's his parents, you know, knowing that RFK Sr. understood what happened with JFK and yet saw the power and was the top lawman in the country and yet knew the power of the people behind it, so he couldn't go after them unless he was actually the president. So he had planned to reinvestigate the assassination if he became president. And he was assassinated before that could happen, also under dubious circumstances. So given all this, I have no doubt about RFK Jr.'s sincerity, because his background, what it must have meant for him to lose his uncle and father the way that he did, and then to eventually, over decades, come to understand the deeper meaning behind it, I cannot believe that he would be cynically using that as a campaign prop. And I think that a real danger for these establishment flacks like Mehdi Hasan, who's basically Big Pharma's rent boy. I know that they launder that money through advertisement buys, but Big Pharma is just puts millions of dollars directly into his bank account. It's absolutely disgusting to hear these corporate propagandists go on the way that they do. But, you know, in a capitalist system, you can find any person to perform basically any, horrific task, that no matter how disgusting it is, you throw enough money at them, you'll find people that do it. And that's what Mehdi Hasan does. So this RFK Jr., his campaign is about peace. He's not running on I want to talk about vaccines and nothing else but Big Pharma corruption. He's running to a campaign for peace. At a time when it's desperately needed, because the U.S. empire is crumbling. And if it's at this point, the option of going for the empire, it's not even available. It's illusory at best. And I hope that enough elements of the establishment and in the democratic, public, smaller, lowercase d democratic public, right? I hope that democracy and some elements of the establishment can come together to put an end to this and reform the U.S. empire, end the U.S. empire and make the U.S. a normal country that takes care of its citizens and tries to use its wealth and technology for the good of the world.
We'll get on to the response of the sort of socialist Bernie left to RFK's campaign in a moment, and also I do want to ask you about what misgivings you might have about parts of his program. But really, the reason why I've been trying to pay attention to RFK Jr. And try to give try to take the campaign seriously and give sympathetic coverage is I think back to the sort of start of the Bernie and the Corbyn projects and how common it was for supposed lifelong socialists and lifelong leftists to just be looking for an excuse to not support the candidate when they've actually arrived, to be kind of nitpicking and looking for some problematic thing that means that they can't in good conscience get behind it. And I think to a great extent it's the same dilemma now. The vaccine thing is highly sensitive and a difficult topic for a lot of people. But if you have any doubt in your mind whatsoever about the assassination of the Kennedys and other deep events in American history, if you have come to the view over the past few years, as many of us have, that domestic policy is downstream from foreign policy, and if you're not going to tackle empire, you're not going to tackle anything. If you think anything along those lines, then you just have to give this man the benefit of the doubt and to give him a hearing, and not to start out looking for excuses not to support him. Let's get into his actual sort of statements and actual policies. I mean, you're sort of drawing a line from this hardly leftist, but just liberal critique of the direction that American foreign policy was going in, that the Kennedys launched in the 60s and most likely died as a result. Let's just hear from RFK himself. Here he is on Joe Rogan within the last fortnight, talking about America's relationship to Ukraine.
And my central issue is, how do you rebuild the middle class, and how do we get out of these forever wars?
How do you get out of the Ukraine war?
The Ukraine war is easy to get out of. I mean, the Russians have been wanting to settle that war from the beginning.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the Minsk Accords was a settlement. And that was, you know, that we basically, you know, encouraged Zelensky. As Zelensky ran in 2019, here's a guy who's a comedian and an actor, which I'm not saying in a disparaging way, but he's...
You probably should.
Well, my wife is those things, too.
Yeah.
So, how did he win with 70% of the vote? He won because he ran on a peace platform, promising to sign the Minsk Accords, which was an agreement that Russia, France, and Germany had all agreed to, which would have left Donbass as part of Ukraine as an autonomous region, so they can now enjoy their own language, the ethnic Russians, and protect themselves from attack by the central government, which was U.S. Installed central government, and that NATO would stay out of the Ukraine, and that's what the Russians wanted—a pledge that NATO will never go in, which we should have made for them. We have no business putting NATO in the Ukraine. We promised we'd never do that. We committed to it.
So the argument goes on. I mean, I don't know how you felt hearing that and hearing similar arguments in RFK's speeches. But this is exactly the narrative that, you know, you basically had to turn to podcasts in order to hear it over the last year or so.
On a number of issues. He's talked about things like the anthrax attacks, which even the senators who were attacked don't have the balls to say what he has said about that, even though they know the government's lying. He talks about how you got to pardon Assange and Snowden, you got to end all of these. I mean, on issue, he's done things on electronic voter fraud. He's out there on the criminality of the state more than any other politician by a mile that has any traction, even further ahead than the Green Party people that have run in recent years, who I generally like, except for, you know, that Howie Hawkins dude.
This is stuff that, if you just do the slightest bit of reading, peer-reviewed publications, the slightest bit of scratching under the surface, and there is just an unrecognizable picture relative to what you get in the New York Times or in mainstream media. And, okay, some opportunists of the right occasionally sort of blurt out a little bit of this, or have done at least since Trump, and a kind of and the sort of vogue for a sort of loose anti-imperialism on the American right at times, but you just never get the whole story laid out in this articulate fashion as RFK is doing. How would you see that this kind of picture of foreign policy that we're getting from him in all these interviews, how would you see that actually playing out were he to become president?
I think it's in line with what most Americans would support and agree with, which is exactly why they want to just avoid all debates. They just want to, they've already spent, you know, an enormous amount of time smearing him over his critiques of the vaccine regime in the United States and his critiques of Big Pharma. So they just talk about that. They say anti-vaxxer, RFK, whatever, which is anti-vaxxer is like a propaganda term from, you know, PR flacks for Big Pharma. And this is, it's, and RFK is not against vaccines. He's been vaccinated himself and he has his children vaccinated. He's saying he wants to make vaccines completely safe. I don't know how safe or not safe they are because that's not my wheelhouse, but that's all they want to talk about. They don't want to talk about the foreign policy because the U.S. foreign policy is indefensible if looked at halfway honestly at all. It is totally lawless. We violate the U.N. Charter all the time at our whim. The U.S. is probably violating the U.N. Charter in hundreds of ways right now as we speak, if not more. And it is also, that is also a violation of the U.S. Constitution, which says ratified treaties are the supreme law of the land. So this is an outlaw regime that we have been living under since the Cold War began. The Cold War ends and the outlaw aspects of it that are supposedly just because it's this emergency, they keep going. Because it was never about the emergency. It was about global empire. And so what he is saying about foreign policy is astounding. It's far better than Bernie. So, I think that it's hard to know what the people on the left, some of them online are probably not legit. They're probably different. I mean, they spend a lot of effort on like signature reduction things. So some of them are probably bots and phonies, but then some of them are probably likely just doctrinaire leftists. I think the problem with the U.S. is so right wing that the left in the United States, I mean, it's commonplace to just say there is no left in the United States. There's a reason that people say that all the time, because it's not literally true, but it's just that the left is completely divorced from institutional power. So I think the only thing the left really does have is like its leftiness. Like all they have is like their left-wing analysis and taking the correct left-wing position. And somehow by sheer force of constant correctness, the revolution will come and they will be proven right or something. I don't understand how they can be so detached from like the political realities and think that this is a meaningful way to do politics. If you're not going to overthrow a country through violent revolution, then you've got to have some other way to engage with the system. And the U.S. is not at that point. And if there were a violent conflict, the people that are the most into, you know, killing people and organizing to prepare for that are not people of a leftist bent. If you think that they are, you're an idiot. So this kind of talk from some of the left is just it's silly, but it's partly a consequence of just how right wing and dystopian the U.S. political system is, because the foreign policy is it. It's the foreign policy that gives, and the empire that gives the status quo, that makes the status quo unassailable. The enormous amount of money that they get from running the global system and having the magic dollar machine at their disposal to fund whatever enterprises they want to run and run whatever kind of deficits they want to run, especially on military spending and other things. They just have all the enemies of the left in the U.S. have all the money in the world. They don't just have all the money. They invented money. Okay, they invented the concept of money. Like they invented the institutions that tell us who can and cannot create money out of thin air. They're so overmatched, but the empire is the heart of it. And that is gone, which is an enormous opportunity for change if people actually grasp what's going on and then try to undertake the lay of the land. Now, I'm not saying that RFK has a strong chance to win, but I think he is trying to win and he's not a protest candidate, which means you can't judge him by the metrics that you might judge a protest candidate. Because if you're going to protest something, then you ought to be telling the truth and nothing but the truth. You don't have to make any compromises because you're protesting by telling the truth. I don't think he's a protest candidate. And that means we have to look at like what he wants to do, what we can believe he's sincere about wanting to do, and how good is what he wants to do. I would say what he wants to do is actually the most important set of things you could do. Ending the American empire, ending the lawlessness of the surveillance state and you know, different oppressive policies, cracking censorship and other things. He is resolutely against those things. So what he wants to do is restore American democracy and the rule of law and end this vicious imperialist system. And I think that if he is successful, or if somebody else is successful in doing this, even if they are not correct on every single issue that people on the left might care about, it will actually allow for democratic debate to potentially influence some of these issues down the road. Because right now, we have a fake democracy. They can assassinate politicians they don't like, or just defeat them with infinite amounts of money. And this is a totally, this is a way of despotism or disguised fascism with phony democratic veneer. And RFK is wanting to end that. He's not explicitly saying it for different reasons that I'm going to end American fascism, but he's coming very close. And as a bullet point of like the things he's against, you can summarize those and say he's against parafascism or the disguised system of fascism in the US.
I got to say that it's one of those moments where you sort of see the workings of the pathologies of the left in how they respond to something like this. We've both given the reasons why RFK needs to be treated at least with some comradely generosity and curiosity, but if not more. But there's a sort of guild rules mentality that's detectable when the left responds to something like this. So I mean Current Affairs, that little Bernieist magazine, just went all out on calling RFK a crank and a liar in a way that I just can't imagine them discussing Joe Biden. Even Crystal Ball, someone I like very much, I thought that when she was interviewing RFK, she started off with a very good question. How are you going to win over this Democratic primary electorate, who are the most paid up pro-vax, pro-pharma people at this point? How are you going to speak to them? And she allowed herself to get sort of sidetracked. Rather than stressing that like pragmatic question, she allowed herself to sort of argue against his view on pharma, which I just think it goes beyond like the individuals at hand. It's almost kind of part of the psychology of this embattled leftism where, yeah, if we're not going to have revolution, then we're absolutely going to defend our sort of brand rights, and we're not going to have anyone else sort of getting onto our territory, certainly not doing it potentially better with more popularity than us. I've got to raise one issue that the left has seized onto in criticizing RFK, where they might have a point. What about Israel? What about RFK declining to extend this critique of American foreign policy to Israel?
Yeah, the way he explains his position on Israel is kind of standard Israel lobby Zionist, you know, myth-making or propaganda, whatever you want to call it, the Jewish people's aspirations for a secure homeland and so on, which I don't think is really supportable by the historical record. I don't support Israel in any way. I don't understand how... Well, I think that part of the issue with Israel is, and the reason it's got unanimous support, okay, in Congress. Like, there is not a congressman or a senator, you know, out of 500 plus, who is against Israel. Like, the leftists are demanding that RFK have a position that not a single member of Congress has. So this shows the level of sophistication in their, you know, political calculations. Now, I disagree with RFK's policies completely. As I've said, I don't have any sympathy for Israel, and because I'm already anathema to academia, and I am not going to get hired by any media outlet anytime soon, I have the luxury of telling the truth. If the ADL wants to come after me, it would probably, you know, help me as much as anything, because it's publicity, and there's no, you know, that's how it works. So I don't, the way that they go after him on this is like, it's annoying for me, because if I'm out there defending him and like, I don't really want to be, I know that I'm going to take a lot of crap for that. I knew this going in, that a lot of people hate him, and like, it doesn't make sense for me, if all I care about is my brand, to talk about RFK. There's a huge publicity machine, you know, cranking out material to make you hate RFK. So why do I put that crown of thorns on my own head? Because I believe that it's a step towards ending the US empire safely, and that is a bigger issue than anything else. Additionally, what he's talking about doing with the empire, which, given his biography and his record of statements on this, I have to believe he's sincere about, nothing would help the Palestinians more than the end of the U.S. empire and an international order characterized more by international law and multi-polarity in terms of the power of the system. So there's that aspect of it. And also the, I mean, well, something needs to be done in Israel. I think it needs to be a signature project of the multipolar world. And that you can think this is ridiculously optimistic or whatever, but my opinion is that Israel could be a way to reorient global politics. As far-fetched as this sounds, it's not. It would be in the interest of everyone for this to happen, I believe, by and large, that there would be a one-state solution in Palestine, enormous aid flowing in for infrastructure and housing and everything else to allow something like the right of return for people who still want to return, who are Palestinians, to, if not the exact place, something comparable in the area. And it would be a state with a rule of law, no apartheid, equal citizenship for people, and massive investment to help to create the infrastructure needed to run that, for a state like that to be stable and prosperous. This could be a way for the world to come together. I think that if RFK were elected, he may migrate to something like that. There could be changes in the world like that. At present, he has the same policy as Bernie Sanders. He's by and large, he's pro two-state solution, which I don't think is feasible at this point. And he's anti-BDS. I'm all for BDS. I don't know that I've ever publicly announced it, but of course I am. And but RFK's position is not an outlier. They're wanting him to take an outlier position that conventionally is understood to disqualify you from political office in the United States. The leftists are aggrieved that RFK Jr. is not doing that. So this is, I think, a fixation that is not constructive in any way. Some of it, I do think, is bad faith from people trying to scuttle these things and sow dissent. I mean, CIA used to have people pretend to be Maoists, or they used to support Maoist groups to go around and perpetrate mischief and fragment the left. They supported groups like Karenga's U.S. slaves and to go against the Black Panthers and other things. They do all sorts of things. But if I think about that too much, then I'll become even more paranoid, and I'm already paranoid about being paranoid, and who thinks I'm too paranoid, which is a symptom of being aware of the kind of system we live under.
Yeah, I've got to say, I mean, my first reaction, it feels a bit strange to be saying this having gone through the Corbyn ordeal to only be more stubborn in the defense of Corbyn, the anti-Zionist left, the anti-Zionist Jewish left, and free speech on this and every issue. Nonetheless, it's almost like, having gone through the Corbyn experience, I can understand why somebody wouldn't want to be Corbyned. And actually, it almost seems like, I don't know, a tick in the actually RFK is serious column at this point, that he just refused to make it an issue, refused to sort of get dragged onto territory that, Bernie, AOC, they declined to get dragged onto this territory as well, for God's sake. If anything, and I don't think I'm just sort of doing a sort of circuitous thinking to try to justify RFK saying something I don't believe to be true, I think that actually there's a sort of seriousness about that no, this is absolutely not the time to kind of volunteer to just have your reputation trashed even further than it has been by taking up that particular nettle.
Especially if your goal is to prevent nuclear doomsday and to bring down the American empire in a peaceful way to avoid the end of human civilization, which is a serious risk at the trajectory that we're on. Why would you say something that could conceivably disqualify you from being able to do that? But that's what the left wants.
Even 10 years ago,
some vocal minority who is definitely a minority.
Even 10 years ago, you could have tried to be sensible about the reality of Israel and Palestine, and you could have thought that you would be able to rely on liberal civil society to sort of back you up. The Corbyn experiment in Britain, at least, showed that that isn't the case, that if somebody tells the truth about Israel and Palestine, then suddenly The Guardian and the London Review of Books and the BBC and anyone who in the past has been accused of anti-Semitism themselves, when they report accurately on these things, they will just drop you and they will pretend not to know you. And they will absolutely, they'll be the most enthusiastic witch hunters of all. So it sounds totally cynical and defeatist, but as a paid-up Corbynister, there's no point in even trying at this point. It's not something that that can be placed at front of shop. The lobby is too powerful. The Liberals are too weak and supine and to tar you with anti-Semitism. What about the pharma and the vaccine stuff? RFK, correct me if this is an accurate picture, but my understanding of him is that for a long time he was a pretty standard Democrat and an enthusiastic environmentalist, and then that trajectory sort of opened his eyes to the extent to which America's natural world is just routinely poisoned, and that man-made poison is getting into people and making them chronically ill and sick. Standard environmentalist critique thus far. And then that also took him into arguments that liberals are less comfortable making, which is that also extends to a lot of pharmaceuticals that people are consuming, and indeed to vaccines. He was critical of vaccination even before COVID, which was a sort of on-ramp for a lot of us, even if you only opposed the vaccine mandates and didn't have a particular critique of the vaccines themselves, the sort of modest anti-lockdown position that we've in general steered on this show. Well, liberals didn't want to hear that, and so RFK became a sort of big figure for the right. He was always on Steve Bannon's show and still is, and had a lot of sort of popularity over there. RFK, he started this campaign saying he didn't want to run on vaccination, and this wasn't going to be a big part of his project as president, as you've said. But perhaps it's inevitable that this is something that gets emphasized in a lot of the coverage. How do you navigate that? Do you think this is just a sort of footnote to the really important thing of the foreign policy, or do you think that there's value in this critique, or is there stuff there that makes you uneasy?
I really have no idea about the minutiae of the health risks associated with vaccination that RFK points to or alleges, whatever you want to say. I think his general critique, as I understand it, which is out of my realm of expertise, but I think a core part of it is that he says vaccines have never been tested against a true placebo, that they are always tested against a cocktail of components that are designed to produce an immune reaction. That's what passes for the placebo, and that he has asked Dr. Fauci to show one study where they actually used a placebo and they didn't. And Fauci never did. Fauci said, oh, I'll get back to you, but he never was able to do that. And so what RFK is wanting to do is to create a new regime of a bureaucracy, of regulatory bodies that are free of any conflicts of interest, and that will have scientists who are disinterested, you know, with no conflicts of interest, doing research to rigorously safety test these things in ways that they have not been done before, so that we can be sure this process is as safe as possible. And so to me, that seems sensible. He's not saying he wants to outlaw vaccines or not allow people to take vaccines. He doesn't want to mandate them, which is in accordance with international law and the things derived from the Nuremberg Code and so on. It's the radical thing is to want to force these on people, which is a violation of of constitutional liberties and the Nuremberg Code, et cetera, et cetera. So RFK's position is not that he's anti-vax. It's that and whenever I've heard him point to explain, this is not for him. It's boilerplate. For me, I couldn't recite the exact structure of it. But I'm a political scientist, and I recall that whenever I've heard him talk about the regulatory structure of these products and the way that they are immune from any liability as a result of congressional acts, wherein, as RFK Jr. tells it, a pharma representative was told Reagan, look, we can't make these things safe enough to actually make them profitable because we're going to pay way more in liabilities than we are in revenues. So please, you have to make this we have to shield us from liability, which is a totally unique thing in the U.S. healthcare system. It's very strange. So that's a very strange, if the vaccines are totally safe, that is a very strange provision in the law to have. Likewise, if the vaccines are totally risk-free, it is also strange to avoid testing them against a true placebo and then recording the results and seeing what the health outcomes are, if indeed that is the case, which, as I say, is out of my wheelhouse. To my mind, if he's wrong about this, then his being wrong would be borne out by studies conducted by a reformed regulatory agency, which at that point would be beyond question, because he would have presumably gotten rid of conflicts of interest and other things that can distort or produce strange results, et cetera. So the magnitude of this issue is so small compared to the global empire issue and the fact that we have a lawless regime that can assassinate presidents and lie about it for 60 years. His critique of the vaccine regime is of much lesser importance, especially when you consider that what he's actually calling for doing are things that seem totally sensible to me in terms of eliminating conflicts of interest and undue industry power in politics and the media. It is outrageous that they can give so much money to politicians, any corporation, but that they can give so much money to politicians, political campaigns, and buy up so much advertising. I mean, they pay for a majority of advertising on the news. There is no way you can sensibly expect to have a good media coverage of this industry when everyone that is in the media is essentially a paid spokesperson for them by way of money laundered through advertising revenues. So ad buys, you know. So it's not my wheelhouse. And if you're obsessed with this issue, then, you know, I don't know what to say to you if people are really preoccupied with it. I think part of the issue is that even people who understand regulatory capture and corporate corruption and so on, it's that the number one, you have the publicity arm of Big Pharma, which is enormous. But additionally, it's so ghastly to think that there are these potential problems in this kind of a system that you don't want to believe it. It's something that could trigger like sort of standard denial mechanisms in humans to say that cannot be. I'm angry at you for saying this. That cannot be. It cannot be harming children. But then you stop and think about, you compare Big Pharma and their lobbying power, and then you look at RFK and what's his organization? Children's Health Defense. When you stop and think about it, what lobbyists are out there who are with power and money, who genuinely are concerned first and foremost with the welfare of children in the United States across the board? There is no group. This is a horrifying part of our system. We have enormous advocacy for corporations and an astoundingly little advocacy for human welfare at this point in time. It's horrifying to contemplate the scope of it, and people recoil from it. And I think that's partly what we see with the reaction to these big pharma critiques.
I think that, well, first of all, the fact that COVID vaccines were, and we'll just stay in the realm of facts that a New York Times reader can agree to here, COVID vaccines that were at best unnecessary for great swathes of people, great swathes of demographics. The fact that they weren't just told that they should take them, but that they were told that they had to take them if they wanted to participate in public life. That the magnitude of that, I don't think has really been acknowledged enough on the left, to say the least. And really, it just should be a red pill about quite a lot of the stuff that's gone on previously.
In the U.S., the healthcare is like the mafia, you know, like a protection racket. They like come to your store, hey, nice shop. Would be a shame if anything happened to you, you know, and then like you pay them money, right? Well, that's the healthcare system. You pay this money to these people that don't really do anything except take your money. But you have to pay it, because if you don't, then you'll die. It's a horrendous system that can't be justified on its own merits, but they can take enough. this mafia can take enough of the money that they get, shaking the public down, so because the public wants to live and be healthy and have health, and then so they take that money and they bribe politicians with it to make sure that the politicians don't touch their racket, so that they can keep going on screwing the American people and creating a system that, you know, kills people. People, because of the system, people die that wouldn't die if you had a system that guaranteed everybody health care. So it's a horrific system. And a Medicare for all would be, that would get rid of, he would kill the private insurance industry with Medicare for all. So that would be, but that's what Obama refused to do. He not only didn't go for Medicare for all, he didn't go for a public option that could compete with the other ones. They could have set up something that's like, okay, well, just do everything the way you did, but also have a U.S. government option and let that be managed on a nonprofit basis, and that can, and then the private corporations can see if they can actually do a better job. But of course, the private corporations can't do a better job because they're trying to make people a whole lot of money at the same time. They're trying to maximize return to shareholders, whereas the public system is just to be organized according to what's going to be the most cost effective and so on, and reduce administrative overhead. So it's like the socialized option is further efficient. It's much more efficient than the for-profit one. But the money on the insurance mafia was able to rig that debate and political process in favor of the racketeers. So we ended up with a terrible Obamacare, which basically reformed healthcare along the lines of the military industrial complex, where it's like government money for private corporations. And Obama had a huge advantage in the Senate and in the House. When he passed that, it's a deeper thing. It's even deeper than just the health insurance industry, in my opinion. I believe that since the 1970s, corporate America, you can read the Powell memo they basically make for the Chamber of Commerce. It basically makes this argument explicitly. Having a prosperous middle class is dangerous, because if they have a little bit of economic wherewithal, they can agitate for better politics and better policies. That happened in the 60s. They were scared. And so economic means, like making college super expensive and saddling people with loans that they have to pay back, making people scared to leave their jobs because they have to pay the health insurance mafia, making people pay ridiculous prices for housing because financial interests have so distorted the whole process of home ownership and so on. All of these things collude to keep Americans in a state of financial precarity that neutralizes them politically and is salutary for the empire, because nobody can stand up against the behemoth oligarchy that runs the U.S. So I think it's even worse than profiteering. There's actually darker, more sinister logic than even what is employed by the sinister health insurance mafia.
Part of the almost built-in problem of the kind of work that you do on deep politics and what is popularly thought of as conspiracy theory, a kind of built-in problem is that the evidence by its very nature has been withdrawn from public sight or has been sort of poisoned and diluted with false flags. And so on. So you can get a Peter Dale Scott book published by University of California Press, but there's a sort of almost an awkward relationship between this kind of research that is given no acknowledgement or acceptance by the official bodies of knowledge, and the kind of form of university discourse and evidence and so on. I'm not sure I've explained that dilemma that well, but you sort of see what I mean. It's a different kind of evidence that you're working with, and it's almost like it's by its very nature circumstantial, because if it was anything else, then the conspiracy wouldn't have worked. I wonder if you sort of hear anything of your own approach and the problems of your own approach and the challenges of your own approach when you hear RFK talking about medicine. I mean, just to take one example, his belief that childhood vaccination does have a relationship with autism, despite the fact that all official medical journals have sort of withdrawn or deleted those articles where they previously claimed that and said actually it was all a mistake or the evidence was false. RFK says, you know, that was the result of a lobbying, that was the result of a highly motivated kind of industry campaign to sort of ban that kind of approach. And also nice, normal doctors and medical researchers who want to think nice and normal things and don't want to think that those mothers who, you know, and I've met them myself, who are absolutely convinced that their kid was one kid before taking the vaccine and a totally different kid afterwards. I don't know, without necessarily getting caught up on the autism thing, is there a sort of parallel there?
There are parallels. Yeah. There are parallels because I can't speak to the autism and the increase in chronic childhood illness because it's not my field of expertise, but what I will say is that there does seem to be pretty clearly an explosion in the incidence of autism and in other things like peanut allergies that have correlated to the imposition in 1989 of this new vaccine schedule. So are they related or not? I don't know. I couldn't say for sure because it's out of my wheelhouse, but the people are reluctant. People try to deny that there's that the explosion in autism is real. And as an educator, I just see more kids that seem to, I was working in high school. There are just more kids that are on the autism spectrum. You would have called them Asperger's people, you know, a decade ago or more or whatever, but there's just more of that. And there's peanut allergies that are statistically measurable. And then when you look at the way these vaccines function by using adjutants or whatever the word is to like increase an immune response, the argument is maybe that's the cause of it, but I don't know. I can't say. And what I did hear RFK once say that, like, look, if it's not the vaccines, it's industrial pollutants or radiation that we've added, you know, Wi-Fi radiation and other things that have never really been totally tested. And the issue is every one of these areas, and they could be colluding in different ways or interacting in different ways that we don't know. But the issue is, all of those areas are verboten in our system because of corporate regulatory capture. So if it's the telecommunications industry, well, you're not going to be able to, the federal regulatory systems don't go after corporate powers that are that, you know, important. If it is agribusiness, and RFK won a huge settlement from Monsanto, which I think is something to be praised.
He's won settlements, and he doesn't get sued. He doesn't get sued. Why isn't Fauci suing him?
He doesn't sue him for libel. He wrote a book on Anthony Fauci. He has a lot of money. He's a nice target. Why don't you take him to court and sue him for libel if he's really lying? Okay? And then let the facts speak for themselves. Let them come out in trial. But they don't. To me, that is noteworthy. But I can't get into the details of it. It just is like, but what I can think of is my own experience in political science.
Yeah.
Political science is not related to one industry in a sense, because it's actually divorced from the US political system. It's just a bunch of nerds doing regression analysis and then talking about p-values and so on. It's, you wouldn't believe what it really is comprised of mostly, especially on the quantitative side. I mean, there are some people that do good work and some people who know that like, bigger questions are not really in their wheelhouse and they just accept it. So whatever. But my point is, there's no industry like selling X product that's connected to political science. And yet the entire cosmology of the discipline is you can see that it is dictated by powerful forces in American society. So you obscure the overdetermining power of corporate influence over foreign policy. You just obscure U.S. imperialism, especially the covert side of it. International relations is a subdiscipline of political science, and they are so oblivious to the concept of covert operations and imperialism in general. I mean, there's a body of people that talk about hegemony, but and so on. But it's all done in a very sterile kind of generic faux realist way that adopts a whole lot of assumptions and methodologies that really obscure the nature of the system that we live under. And if you go against that, you cannot be published in the top journals. You're not going to get a tenure track job, et cetera, et cetera. So I've seen how powerful orthodoxies can be established to perpetuate a status quo, even when there's not really an obvious, you know, racket attached to it, as with political science. When it comes to things like health, you know, research on the health industry and things that bear on vaccines and other products related to, you know, pharmacology and so on, then you are talking about a whole lot of money changing hands. So if political science can be so corrupted and turned into a scholasticist discipline to legitimate the status quo without it even being connected to a big source of profits, you can only imagine what it's like for people who work in fields that are totally dependent on, that are intertwined with industry and huge centers of corporate profit making. I would be shocked if you have to think of a magical mechanism that would somehow make big pharma, that would keep big pharma from being just as corrupt as big oil, Lockheed Martin in the defense industry, big tech, the banks, the big banks on the too big to fail banks like JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs, you know, Monsanto. Like the pharmaceutical industry employed people in the past. They gave sinecures to people like Donald Rumsfeld and George H.W. Bush after the Ford administration, right? They worked in the pharmaceutical industry. It's like a sinecure. Eli Lilly had a relationship with the CIA. They synthesized acid back in the day. I mean, who knows how they worked on different projects to do this or that horrific criminal thing the CIA wanted done in the realm of research. I mean, there is, it's magical thinking to think that the pharmaceutical industry, with all of its money that it throws to media and politicians and to its executives and stockholders, that they are somehow not corrupt and that they are beyond reproach. Like it must be a powerful PR apparatus that could make people think that in any way, shape or form. And that's what we're dealing with.
Well, the empire is losing some of its control, at least over information. And the fact that RFK is running and is so popular with this program is evidence for that. And it would be a grave error, I think, for the left or anyone invested in radical change to dismiss that out of hand. It's been great talking to Aaron Good, author of American Exception, Empire and the Deep State, and also the podcast of the podcast of that name. I don't know. Let's end on the libtard defense of RFK, that he would probably beat Trump and the right would vote for him joyfully. And he is actually a sort of unifying figure in bringing together quite a lot of the concerns of both right and left in America right now.
I would say something about this. The right, the right wing, more conservative members of the public are, I'm from Southern Indiana, so I've known more conservative people my whole life. There are decent people who of different political persuasions in the U.S. I think that, you know, to me, the liberals are way too far to the right of where they should be, you know, intellectually, from that perspective. But so the right wing, I don't agree with them on very much. But your regular right wingers in the United States, or many of them, that no, people do not support what the U.S. actually is. Like this, like even the Republicans don't run on America must be the global empire. We must continue to exploit the rest of the world to the hilt. We must let our corporations make as much money as possible and screw the public forever. And we must also allow the national security state to assassinate elected leaders if they get out of line. That's the regime that we actually have. And that is, I don't believe that fundamentally conservative people support that. Nobody supports that. But the liberals are in denial about it. And honestly, much of the left is in denial about how sinister and covertly fascistic this regime is. And so if RFK has a path to victory that is going to be forming a coalition that we've not yet seen of people who just want the rule of law and democracy and an end to total corporate corruption of screwing everybody all the time, if that, and also supporting personal freedom and the constitutional rights and civil rights, that's a positive move in my direction. I think that if it means going out and talking to, you know, the conservative moms of Peoria or whatever groups, that, I mean, more power to anybody with the fortitude to go and speak to those people, because they're human beings and they are disgusted by this system and worried about their children's future. And if we can get rid of this fascistic imperial system that threatens us all domestically and internationally, then you can have a debate and sort some of these problems out in a democratic way that can allow things to develop in a more humane way, not just dictated top down by dark forces that are divorced from human, day-to-day human lives. So if he can win over people that are more conservative to this cause, and we can make common cause against this behemoth, and then get about the business of transforming this society even more radically, then more is the better. At the very least, we can remove this nuclear sword of Damocles that is hanging over us, and which people like Joe Biden seem to be trifling with. That's more important than anything else, to be honest.
Aaron Good, thanks so much for joining us on The Popular Show to give the deep case for RFK.
Thank you, James.